Welcome to the BioBalance Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Kathy Maupin, founder and medical director of BioBalance Health, located in St. Louis. Today, Brett Newcomb and I will discuss anthropology, my favorite subject, the origins of our sexuality, what we're hardwired to do and to think and to, and the type of thing that has been with us since we were cavemen.
Yeah, that is such a loaded terminology. And you and I have had this conversation repeatedly because we come from different training sets, and I tend to be more focused on the cultural impacts, and you tend to be more focused on the physiological structure of the organism and the sources of sexual arousal, sexual desire, sexual attraction from a physiological standpoint. And I look at it from how does culture modify it or modify itself, the culture, in order to accommodate the physical demands of sexual energy. So,
I like to look at it like, well, we're hardwired that way, and we spend so much energy in society taking that out of our set of talents or set of activities. We try to change how we're hardwired. I look at what to make it efficient. What can't we change?
Well, yeah, we try to. I look at it from the standpoint of we try to dominate our biology. You know, I want to eat all this incredible stuff that tastes good, but it's killing me. You know, it's putting cholesterol and fat and, you know, I love things with gravies and sauces and cheeses, and I'm not supposed to eat it. So how do I dominate my physiological hunger for some of these things? And what can I learn? What, you know, where's the distinction between physiological hunger and psychological hunger, whether it's for food or whether it's for sex?
Same thing.
It's a different thing. It's absolutely the same thing. And so then why am I attracted to what I'm attracted to? And, and you know, does stress in my life affect my awareness of it? Does it affect the instigation of it or the resolution of it? Whether we're talking about a hunger for food objects or whether we're talking about a hunger for sexual objects. I think it was Judy Blume, and forgive me for not having this quote available, just popped into my head. But once somebody said something, I think it was her, about adolescent males have a sexual thought about every 8 seconds.
That's right.
And I think, oh my God, when I was young, that certainly was true for me.
And that's hardwired. No one's going to be able to change that, which is our problem with teenage sex, teenage children out of wedlock, because it's our strongest instinct to have sex and have sex early to help fill the planet.
So it comes from what you call the procreative urge.
Right.
You know, the physiology kicks in when we go through puberty.
And testosterone's at its highest, and growth hormone is at its highest, and that
makes all the systems are firing.
Our brains
and they're all firing at the target of procreation.
Right.
So physiologically, we are. There's an imperative that impels us to be aware, to recognize or experience hunger, and to seek some level of satiation to quiet that physiology down.
Mm-hmm.
So then we develop all kinds of behaviors. I say we develop them, they just occur. I mean, babies will masturbate. Young kids will masturbate.
Yeah, I've done ultrasounds, and boys are in the womb
in utero.
Masturbating.
Yeah.
Masturbating is kind of a natural thing. You can't really stop that.
So when a father says to a son, get a grip on yourself, actually he's months too late.
Yeah.
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 But get a grip on yourself in terms of you have to learn socially appropriate responses to those urges that are adaptive to the culture that you live in, and they are different in different cultures.
That's true.
So
how smart we get or how socialized we get,
yeah,
this part is the part that's not going away.
I once had a couple come in and see me. They had a 4 or 5 year old son that they had just put in school, and they were concerned because he constantly sucked his thumb and fondled his genitalia. And they were worried about, you know, what should we do about that? What should we do about that? And, you know, and there are things that you begin to teach them that are not shame-based and that are not, you know, physical punishment-based, but you have to teach them to control the physical release or physical outlet of the urge. But what I told them is, don't worry about it. I taught high school for 20 years, and I never saw a young man come in and do those things that didn't intend to do those things. You know, it's not a compulsion that you can't learn to master. So part of the challenge of our lives is, how do we learn to ride the rhythms of those physical urges in socially appropriate ways?
And live within our own society.
And live within our own society, absolutely. And it is such, I mean, a lot of what I deal with in counseling revolves around accommodations that people have made about sexual issues in their life, desires that they have, fantasies that they have, things that their religion tells them are forbidden or are only acceptable in certain restricted parameters. And then as a physician, you have people coming to you, I would think, from the other end of the same stick to say, okay, I got this happening to me and I want some help with it in some way. So, so maybe you can speak to what you know about sexual arousal, sexual energy, procreative urge from the physician's perspective.
Well, most of the time when people came to me when I was in just GYN or an OB, it was an unwanted pregnancy or it was a sexually transmitted disease they got by being sexual. And they viewed it as a punishment. And it's hard to explain, give them grace and say, this is a natural urge. You've succumbed to it. And so now, yeah, we have to deal with this, and then you're going to have a baby, and you know, even if that wasn't your plan, but that they're really okay. They made a mistake. Humans all make mistakes in terms of societal rules. Usually they're based on the things that are hardwired in us, the urges that are hardwired in us, and giving my patients grace about that and being able to accept it and move on. Let's deal with the problem at hand is usually how that's dealt with. Now I'm dealing with people who, even though they have all these instincts, instincts are dependent on having all of your hormones present. And if they don't have the hormones present, they've lost the desire to procreate, probably because they're menopausal and they weren't meant to procreate at this stage. But when they get their hormones back, then they get their sex lives back. I have a whole different kind of problem now. Not that it's not, oh, you've made a mistake generally, or you have a problem in your marriage.
Right.
It's you have a problem in your marriage because you're not having sex with your husband or your wife because you don't have that urge anymore.
Right. Because your body's changed.
Yeah,
so we're not talking about the more extreme fertility interventions of a 60-year-old woman carrying a fetus.
No. I haven't ever had to deal with something like that.
Yeah. Now you read about those things in the news media, and because they're so unusual, they're treated as really, really bizarre. Mm-hmm. And so then you get into conversations about these issues and automatically seem to stand at the edge of the mainstream.
Well, in general, you just think logically, logic is your thing, but logically, we shouldn't die before our children are mature.
Yeah.
And so having a baby at 60-something and maybe dying in our 70s, they would not be matured in our society.
Well, yeah, that's a real concern. And in any culture, how do we sequence our birth population to fit what the resources in the community are and the ability of us to feed them and house them and supply them, but also of us as parents to take care of them? And to that end, you and I have had some conversation, there's literature out there. It talks about differential approaches genetically for men and women in terms of these issues of attraction and procreation and the urge to nest, to create families, to have monogamous marriages. You know, is monogamy a cultural situation or is it a physiological situation?
Monogamy actually is not instinctual. It is something that we've developed with society.
So then, is any form instinctual? Is polygamy instinctual or is polyandry instinctual? Would you make...
Define.
Well, polygamy is a situation where one man has several women. And polyandry is a situation where one woman has several men.
Well, that's where you go back to, that's why you go back to anthropology and say, what was wired
there
for
are
us?
Cultural reasons for both of those patterns that you can go back and identify.
When the world, when we were all in Africa, where the origin of our species or our humanity is, then there was plenty of things to eat, and there were, our job was to have babies. Mm-hmm. That was, we were meant to populate the earth. And
go forth and multiply.
And women can only populate one baby at a time, but men can bring about multiple pregnancies.
So as you go up the ladder among mammals, as mammals become larger and more complex, and the breeding strategy for those mammals changes. Instead of having litters, they have one or two offspring at a time.
Right.
And the same thing is true for human beings.
Humans were made to have one baby at a time.
So outside of, I guess, physical accidents where the cells subdivide and you get twins or triplets or quadruplets, or those accidents that occur because we're playing with the systems in terms of fertility treatments, you now get some situations where people have a litter, John and Kate make eight sort of thing.
Right.
But most of humankind throughout most of human history has had one baby at a time.
Right, but it's the woman taking care of the baby after impregnation. So what anthropology tells us is that we have generally a man would stay with the woman he impregnated in originally for an 18-month period because that got her through the attachment, the pregnancy, and a few months of breastfeeding, but then she's not fertile for the rest of her breastfeeding. So generally they would change partners, or they would have multiple partners at the same time.
Right.
That it, with the purpose being fill the world with people.
Mm-hmm.
And children died early, so there was a great death rate in babies and children. And to get an adult from a couple of two people would maybe take six or eight children.
Right. To have one reach adulthood.
Right. And so you have to have more children than those two people to make the population grow. So the goal would be to have three or more actually reach adulthood so that they could then have more babies. However, adulthood was 12.
So those things adapt. I mean, you talk about hunting and gathering societies. You talk about agricultural or agrarian societies. You talk about industrialized societies as the methodology for survival. Economic survival changes, then the statistics on women dying in childbirth, women living through childbirth, how many babies an average woman would have or attempt to have, all of those things begin to change because the culture has changed.
Absolutely.
And so now we're at a situation in our culture where we live longer as a group, as a population, than anybody ever has. And our bodies are still functioning according to imperatives that are tens of thousands of years old. And so our cycles are constructed to have us go through the curve and die off at 35 or 40, but we're living to be 80 or 85. So what happens to the sexual urge? What happens for sexual outlets? I mean, if I'm in the nursing home, is there going to be a way for me to have any kind of sexual energy or any kind of sexual intimacy that maybe nurtures me in ways that are not specifically sexual functions, but that are part of that whole process for me?
There's some very active nursing homes. But having said that, because we've changed, and we've become intellectualized, and we've changed the norms for our society, and society has become more intellectual, and we found ways to live to 90 or 100.
Yeah.
Now we've figured out how to get there. We haven't figured out how to have a quality life that way. So what happens is we were supposed to die off like all other mammals after we were able to make babies. As soon as we didn't make babies anymore, then our lifespan should be over because our job was over. Now we've extended our lives so much with medicine, clean water, immunizations, all of those things. Yet we haven't been able to successfully extend our productive lives because we haven't embraced the fact that to get past this the change at 50 or 40, where we lose our hormones, we actually need them back to live a quality life as we know it. Our quality of life is not just surviving and living in a nursing home for 20 years at the end of our lives. Yeah. It's actually living and producing creative works or all the things that you can do once you've retired from the job that fed your children.
Yeah, I don't want to be parked at the end of the hall and just wait to die.
Actually, that's one of the major goals of my practice, is to let people have a quality life or guide them to have a quality life their whole life.
Yeah.
And not be in a nursing home or not lose their mind or their body. Usually people lose one or both, but they're still alive. Their heart's beating.
So I may have a retirement age for Social Security in terms of my working life, but I don't have to have a retirement age in terms of my partner and an attraction or sexuality.
Right. And as long as two people in a couple are willing to embrace the fact that they both need their sexuality.
So you have couples in their 70s who come and see you for treatments to maintain their ability to still have an active and functional and regular sexual experience.
Yes, I do. Actually, I have a couple that's 85 and 87.
85 and 87.
And they're still doing it. And they're
smiling all the time. That's hopeful.
Because, I mean, part of this whole thing is we're wired to be sexual beings. Uh-huh. It makes us healthier. It makes us feel better. We get endorphins. We get all kinds of perks for having sex that make us feel better, less depressed, more secure.
So that's sort of a serendipity. That those are ancillary benefits to, in our last podcast, we were talking about hormone replacement therapy and the physiological benefits mm-hmm. in terms of aging, osteoporosis, heart disease, and so on. Mm-hmm. But there's an ancillary benefit of the intimacy and the relationship strength that comes from having a compatible, physical, satisfying relationship.
Absolutely. And, you know, people who are married live longer.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, all the research
both men and women. Yeah. So, I mean, part of that has to do with just cohabiting and taking care of one another. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it has to do with having a satisfying emotional and sexual relationship.
So if I make a commitment to a woman to ride the river, as they used to say on frontier
days.
What
does that mean?
To ride the river with her, to take the journey to the end of our lives
right.
together. I don't have to lose the saddle.
So to speak. Okay.
So to speak.
I've actually never heard that one before, and I've heard a lot of them. Well, you know, that's right. I mean, you don't have to lose that. And that's something, you know, even though we are trying to control all of those instincts that we've had from day one.
Yes.
We control them. We keep them in a very societal, safe place. We shouldn't have to lose everything. We shouldn't have to lose in our safe place. We shouldn't lose our sexual desire. We shouldn't lose our sexual gratification or fantasies. But when hormones are gone, people lose all of that. And the saddest problem is when people are monogamous and they're married and one of them loses their hormones and the other does not.
Yes.
And then, or the other one replaces them and sees the value in it and the other doesn't, then we have a very inequitable position. And that's where I send them to you, because I don't fix that kind of problem. I can only replace their hormones. That takes a lot of counseling and
negotiating. Mentality of perception and awareness and the willingness to make the efforts that's involved or take the risks that's involved mm-hmm. to try to restore that relationship, restore that balance, is a psychological issue. You are dealing with the physiological aspects of that. And what you've told me is that sometimes, and it all varies according to couple, but sometimes just the physiological restoration is enough.
Right.
But sometimes it is not. The body may restore, but the relationship may need some work.
Or the relationship needs to come to you before both partners will be replaced and be able to think about having sex together again.
Right, because they're hurt or they're angry or mm-hmm. they're tired or they figure it's too much work or they even think, it's the seasons of life, and so we're beyond that. So just get over. You know,
my favorite thing is I want to be all natural. I want to be I just want to let nature take its course. I said, okay, so then you're going to get wrinkled, dried up, and die. That's nature. Now, if you want to, because we've already made that first step to defy nature.
Yeah.
We've cleaned our water, cleaned our environment, made things safe. We've done all those first steps. You can't just go, oh, I'm not playing anymore. Because now, if you don't replace your hormones, then you are just going to maybe not die for 30 years, God forbid, or 40 years, but you may have to live crippled, not being able to think or not being able to move or having arthritis that's so bad you can't function. But worse yet, not having your normal instinct to have sex and have the benefits from it.
And the primary benefit of that being intimacy, the connection, the anchoring connection to another person that makes the spice in terms of quality of life and life worth living for so many people, not for everybody, but for most people. That's the hunger that we have, is to find somebody to ride the river with, to partner with, to always count on and be anchored to. And the sexual intimacy is one of the strongest adhesive bonds that makes those relationships work.
When you have a monogamous relationship, you cut a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You go into it cutting a deal that these certain things are going to happen within this relationship. And it's dishonest and unfair to just pull out of the deal and say, sorry, not doing that anymore. I mean, that's not the deal. That
you leave somebody abandoned and rejected.
Right.
And you can hang it on the hook of, well, you know, that's just the way life happens, you know.
Right.
But you don't have to.
But that's not good for a relationship.
It's not good for relationships at all. And the marvelous piece of this conversation is that you offer an alternative. There is something out there that can be done if people are willing to look at it.
But they can't be forced to do it. I've had couples bring their spouse in and say, fix her or fix him. You know, I can't do that part. I have to have the person want to have their lives back.
Yes.
And that's a big jump, and that's a psychological jump. But part of the point of talking about this whole progress that we've made from cave people to now is that we have now intellectualized everything. Sex is no longer sex. It means something else, or it means intimacy or relationship. We are now, our society has now allowed us to be much more elevated in terms of our goals and what we want. Sex isn't just an urge that you then satisfy.
What was that Walt Disney movie that was out 2 years ago, 3 years ago, about the robot? The world had been destroyed, and there was this little robot that was like,
my daughter's 25. I missed that one.
Well, I still have a young child, and we went to see it. But all of the people lived in a spaceship interacting through computers. They didn't talk to each other. They physiologically were just all fat. They didn't walk. They couldn't stand. They didn't use their muscles. They just existed and consumed, connected through technology. And the whole point of the movie was rediscovery of the Earth and regeneration of the Earth. And these people finally had to get out of their chairs and start to walk and function and see each other and, you know, begin to have relationships again.
You know? And based on, that's part of being human. I mean, none of this says when we first were made, we were alone.
Right.
We weren't alone. Life is about relationships. However those relationships may be constructed, dependent on society, it's about relationships with someone else. It's about touching. It's about holding. It's about nurturing. It's about being nurtured. All of those things are needs that human beings have. And those are needs that need to be satisfied.
So again, the consistent message through all of these podcasts is that there are two critical ingredients in happy and successful relationships. One is the communication and commitment of the relationship and the ability to talk about things and solve problems, discuss problems, negotiate, compromise. But the other is the physiology and the changes in physiology that naturally occur, but that can be counterbalanced by new medical research and new medical technology, which is the component that you offer. So people who feel anchored in their relationships but recognize their physiology has changed need to come and see you or to contact somebody in your office about the treatment protocols that are available. If they're not anchored in those relationships, but they recognize that the physiology has changed and they come and see you and the physiology responds, and then they want to come see someone like me to work on the relational issues, all of those options are out there for the hungry consumer who needs these things in their life and has become aware of it.
That's a wonderful summary, and that's exactly what we wanted to talk about today.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next week, we'll discuss the anthropology of beauty and what beauty has to do with attraction and how aspects of beauty are universally attractive.
Yeah, you need to tell me because, I mean, it's like the old saw, I don't know art, I just know what I like.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know beauty, well, but I know what I'm drawn to.
They've dissected this.
Yeah, great.
They've dissected this.
Well, we'll have that conversation. I'll look forward to it.
There are actually people who study this stuff.
I'll certainly be here next week.
Okay. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email us at podcast@biobalancehealth.com, or for more information, visit biobalancehealth.com on the web. You can call us at 314-993-0963. Thanks for listening.